You're listening to episode 17 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Starting out with listener feedback as usual, I only have actually one listener email from this last time period since the previous show, mainly I think because I'm recording this early, because when you're hearing this, the moment that you're actually hearing this, I am in North Carolina at the Southeast Linux Fest, so I'm recording this pretty well in advance. Actually, I have two. One was from, I don't know how to say this, I should know how to say this, but I don't, Kuvmo. Q-U-V-M-O-H, however you would say that. I forget how he pronounces it. I'm pretty sure I've heard it before. He emailed me this story about urban camping, specifically a quote-unquote tireless entrepreneur who squatted at AOL. This was an interesting article from news.cnet.com talking about some guy living in AOL, living at AOL. And the spin of it, I mean, that's great. I loved that idea of someone living at AOL, bucking the system like that. Really cool. The spin of the story was, though, this extreme kind of entrepreneurial spirit that this guy had, and how everything was kind of okay because it was all in the name of starting his own startup. How indicative, you know, it's just everything's okay as long as the bottom line, or as long as the end, the moral of the story is, well, I started my own business. So I guess pretty much whatever you want to do, you can pretty much do as long as it's going to end up starting your own business. It's just kind of amusing, I thought. But thank you, Kuvmo, for the link. It was an interesting read. Another email I got was from a guy named Erno, who I don't think I'd heard from before, so that was kind of cool to hear from someone new, as always. And he says that he's on a network at a school, and he cannot download OGG files for some reason. He's not really sure why. If he goes out onto a server, like a, you know, VPS or something like that, then he can download the OGG to that server, and then he can rename it to, you know, GNU World Order _7x16.exe, and then he can download that through his network. But for some reason, cannot get an OGG file. And he's talked to the IT department, and they claim that OGG content is not blocked, but he still can't get to it. So I don't know. I've never heard of anything quite... I mean, I've heard of networks blocking file types, but I've not heard of networks... You know, I mean, it seems like if they did, they would tell him, but maybe they didn't. Maybe they don't know. I mean, you never really can tell. But if you've heard of this, let me know, and if you know of an answer, then let me know. Seems like his hack is working. I mean, just rename it to .exe. And that, of course, I found a little bit amusing as well, because, I mean, I realize that either a .ogg or a .exe or a .whatever is equally likely to have, say, a virus or something like that embedded in it. But, I mean, a network that lets .exes through before it lets .oggs is kind of funny to me, because the two of those file types that are more likely to have a virus, or a Trojan, or malware, spyware, whatever, I would probably go with the .exe before I would go with the .ogg. It's just me, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, interesting problem. Cool little solution. I love to hear about this thing. I think that a lot of people, I mean a lot of people, probably not people listening to this show necessarily, but a lot of other people don't understand that the file extension has nothing to do with anything. I mean, I know that I didn't know that at one time, so I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people... And I've done that sort of thing. Like, I'll be helping a friend on some web thing or something, and I'll upload a file, you know, meetingnotes.list or meeting.notes, you know, I mean, just whatever extension I wanted to call something, and they'll be like, is that a valid extension? Like, how's that going to work? I'm like, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's just a file. I'll pull it down and I'll open it because it's a text document and it won't really matter. And then I'll remember that actually if they're going to download it to their computer, which is not a Linux computer, then it might sort of weirdly matter. It's going to really not be easy to open straight off, you know, just double-clicking it and having something open it. It's kind of interesting that some OSs really do kind of try to enforce strict rules about those file endings, and it's kind of refreshing to let people know that it, you know, you can rename something .list or .foo and it's not going to destroy the file. You know, it's a name. It doesn't matter. Yeah, the icon might change. It might change from a text document to, or from a music document to a text file document. It looks scary, but the data is still intact, something that not everyone realizes. Okay, I think that's about all the email that I got for this time, so let's move on. Thank you. this past Friday, I think it was, I went to a local instance, I would say, of a security conference called B-Sides. B-Sides apparently has its roots as sort of the alternative to, I think it was Black Hat. I could be wrong on that. It could be DEF CON. It's one of those two big ones. And apparently some people's talks didn't get into the big conference, so they just forked it, essentially. They rented a house in Vegas and had an alternative conference. I don't know if it was at the same time or if it was like a day after, or if there was any offset, or if it was just direct competition. I don't know. Point is, it exists. It's another conference, but it became, I guess, sort of like almost a bar camp sort of thing, or a traveling conference almost, because apparently there are local B-sides in different areas. So this one was the B-sides for my city, and I found out about it from a friend, Integral, actually. You might know him from Tech Misfits. And so I signed up, and I went, and it was really cool. It was a one-day little conference. There was only one track of talks. It wasn't like you had a whole lot of choice, for instance. I mean, you sat in a room and heard a very specific set of talks. It wasn't like you really could leave. I mean, you could leave, but, I mean, there wasn't any alternative. They had a lockpick village there, which was great. I didn't actually bother going over to that. I probably should have, but I didn't have my set with me, so, and I was really interested in the talk, so I just never really made it over there. And when I did go over there, there were a lot of people there, so I didn't really have a chance to grab a pick and try. But it was really good. It was a great conference. The first talk of the day was about reverse engineering security patches to find exploits. So, in other words, you take the security patch that has just been released, and this was all done on Microsoft security patches, so it was very specific to decompiling these patches. Because obviously the patches that Microsoft sends out are not patches that are, you know, you can't just look at them. You know, they're not open source patches. Shock and surprise. They're binary patches that are applied to different components of the system. So it's all about decompiling those things and then looking at what's different between what you just decompiled on the patch and what it is patching. So, you know, what the alternative, what the unpatched code is like. You look at those two things, you kind of sort through them, sift through them. I mean, it's a lot of investigation, and seeing him do it seemed like it was the easiest thing in the world, but I'm anticipating that it's probably not. And then he got into assembly code, naturally, and figured out, you know, showed us how, more or less, how to figure out what a certain system call is really doing. So you see things like some kind of conditional statement, or rather the patch is repairing a conditional statement. For instance, if there's more than 128 digits here, then do that. Well, that means that unpatched, there wasn't that conditional statement. It was simply, there's more than 128 characters here, uh-oh. You know, so because the patch is saying if there's more than 128 characters, then fail gracefully, meaning that the patch didn't fail gracefully, essentially, or the unpatched version didn't fail gracefully. Do you know what I mean? So if you figure out what exactly is being patched, then you know that unpatched, if you force that place in memory to contain more than 128 characters, then you know it will, as long as it's unpatched, it will fail ungracefully. It might blue screen of death, it might, I don't know, I guess it could theoretically hand you root permissions. Actually, not theoretically. There was one, I think, that he talked about that gave you basically remote control. You know, you could remotely execute code from one of these little tricks. It was I think it was the DNS, some kind of DNS patch or something. Or not DNS, but it had something to do with the DNS records of a Windows server or something like that. So then he went in and sort of showed how, again, assuming that your target is an unpatched version of whatever, here's what you would need to send to it in order to get it to have a buffer overflow, I guess is what it would be called, and then it would fail ungracefully. And again, failing ungracefully could be anything, from a blue screen of death to rebooting to shutting down to just an infinite loop to handing you control of that machine. And these aren't necessarily things that you need physical access to that machine for. Some of them you would, some of them you wouldn't. It really depends on on the patch. But the point of the talk was, aside from just being really cool, was that this is what obviously malware authors are doing, right? I mean, the minute a patch set comes out, they're sitting there decompiling it or looking at it if it's open source, and figuring out how they can exploit all the boxes in the world that aren't patched yet. Interesting stuff, and kind of underscoring drastically how important it is to patch machines. It was a really interesting talk. This was like 8:30 in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning or something like that, and we're going over assembly code. That's kind of how cool this conference was. Anyway, the last talk, there were lots of great talks. The last talk at this conference was a QR code experiment. And the mention of QR code, interestingly, apparently got the local news to come out and kind of like videotape some of the stuff. Not the talk itself, but they came out because it was too late in the day. But they came out in the middle of the day, kind of got some footage, interviewed some people, I guess, and left. But from what I heard, it was because the QR code mention. So you'd think, oh, QR codes must really be popular. Turns out they're not, and I think that most of us geeks know that QR codes aren't that popular. Like, people seem, there does seem to be, for some reason, recognition of them, and some vague knowledge that, yes, you can hold your cell phone up to them and scan them. I think people have seen them enough now on, like, concert tickets, maybe some posters here and there, but as to whether people are actually scanning them, I don't know. And this QR code experiment was an idea of going around to different things with QR codes on them and placing your own QR code over them. And he was trying to track how many people actually scanned these things and went to his site. And obviously the implication is that he could have sent them anywhere and probably gotten them to click on some, you know, Java or Flash thing and then pwn their box or their phone or whatever. Although his code didn't actually, you know, the place that he was sending them wasn't like that. It just said, you know, this isn't a real QR code site. Be careful what you scan in the future. There are two things about this. Number one, in order to get accurate feedback from, or, you know, accurate statistical data, I think you'd have to just absolutely flood the city that you're in with your own QR codes. I mean, 80, 100, 200, that's not going to cut it. You know, you would have to have so many out there in the wild to get really a lot of people to scan them. So he didn't get a lot of scans at all. And I think he was a little bit surprised by that, but I didn't feel his numbers would have warranted, even if people were just QR code crazy, that would be crazy with a Q. QR code crazy, I just don't think that, I mean, you'd have to just have so many out there to really get a lot of numbers of scans. But secondly, I don't know that the thing that we all say, like, oh, QR codes are dangerous. Well, yes, I agree, QR codes are dangerous. I don't scan them. And in fact, at the conference, a person was handing out flyers with a QR code, like, dead center in the flyer, and the first thing I thought was, like, there's no way I'm scanning this, first of all. The second thing I thought when I saw that the last talk was a QR code experiment, I thought, oh, this is certainly part of that experiment. I'll bet you anything if you scan that, it'll take you to some malicious site. Turns out it wasn't. It wasn't connected at all. It was just a geek conference, so you're going to see QR codes. But I do think that we all say, okay, they're dangerous, but what's the alternative? You know, I mean, we're not giving people an alternative, or we don't know of an alternative. I guess the only alternative I can think of would be for the phone scanning devices to not just take you to the site, but to say, you're about to be taken to this URL. Is that okay? You know, to actually, I guess, decipher what that QR code contains before you allow it to do anything like executing whatever it contains or showing you what it might contain. I guess that would be the takeaway lesson from that in general, even though his experiment by his own account didn't really work, quote unquote. I mean, I'm pretty sure I heard somewhere that experiments can't work or not work. I mean, that's why they're an experiment. You're testing something. And I guess the idea would be to, yeah, encode or for decoders to warn the user of what they're about to do after you scan it. You know, make it safer to be able to scan these codes, and then maybe they'll, I guess, catch on a little bit, or at least some geeks will feel safer, you know, like the 10 geeks that are going to scan your code will feel safer about doing it. Somewhat related to that, Crayon, K-R-A-Y-O-N, from, well, you might hear him on Kernel Panic, Ogcast, or you might know him from IRC, Ogcast Planet channel. But he sent somebody, I think it was the HPR mailing list actually, a tip about a little program called QR Encode. It's a command line QR encoder. Generator, I should say. Well, both. I'd heard of this. I think Pokey had told me about it. I've heard of it from a couple of people. I'd never really, I guess, seen the command, and it looks pretty easy. It's just QR encode. Obviously, you have to install that first, but QR encode space dash L space capital H. I don't know what that stands for. Space dash S space 4. I don't know what that's controlling either. Space dash O hpr.png space http://hackerpublicradio.org. So the dash O obviously is the output graphic that it's going to generate, and the URL there is obviously the thing that it is encoding. And there you go. You know, you run that command QR encode, and you end up with in this case, hpr.png, which would be your little QR code that would then send them to hackerpublicradio.org. So if you are in need of a QR code in a generator, then try that out for size. I was doing some mild file system work the other day. Not really anything fancy, a little bit fancier than what I'd really done before, and I was really trying to wrap my mind around this whole partitioning and unpartitioning sort of concept, and there were some interesting things that I was trying out. It all stemmed because I wanted to make a thumb drive with Fedora 17 ISO on it. I didn't want to burn it to a DVD. I just wanted to download the ISO, put it onto a thumb drive, boot off of that, and do the upgrade. That was how it started. And because of that, I realized, a couple of different things and some interesting things. I might have mentioned this one before, but this was fascinating to me, that you don't need a file system if you want to simply copy dump a bunch of data onto a device. You can do it. I mean, this is what tape archives was all about. You know, there was no file system on a tape drum or whatever they called them, on the tape machines, tape decks, I guess. I don't know. But when they were doing literally, they were tarring things up, tape archive, and they were dumping this big backup to a tape drive. There's no, you don't format the tape as EXT4 or something, or EXT2 or whatever. You simply DD or tar it from here to this device, and it's straight out to the device. Really fascinating, at least to me, because I've never done that really before. You know, I mean, I've always made a file system. That's just what you do before you copy stuff to a disk. Now, granted, it's not something you want to do every day, probably. It's not like, oh, who needs the file system? Not like I'll ever want to search for that thing. Well, yeah, you kind of do. But you could, I mean, in theory, you wouldn't have to. You could say, okay, I know that it's on this tape at this marker point. That's where the file begins, at this byte count. The file begins here, and it lasts until there, and so if I copy from this byte to that byte, then I'll have that file again on my hard drive. Guess what we've just learned? We've just learned why file systems are so handy. I never understood that before. Maybe you did, I don't know, but I had never understood that before. I never realized, really, never really had it in my head. I guess on some level I did, but I didn't understand that if you had a file like slackermedia.txt, it's 484,600 bytes. I happen to know that because I using it during these tests. 484,600 bytes. You could DD that over just straight to a device, like /dev/sdd. It could be your tape drive, it could be a thumb drive, whatever, without a file system on it. You can DD that straight over to that device, and then you can read it back into a new file simply by saying, okay, now DD from byte 0 to byte 484,600 back onto my hard drive. Name it slackermediarecovered.txt, and you'll have that file. It's simple as that. Now, obviously, if you had a bunch of files on that tape drive or a bunch of files on that thumb drive, whatever, then you would, if you were tarring things or DDing things over to that thing, you would have to tell it, okay, I need you to start at 484,601 bytes and continue until such and such, because I already have Slacker Media, now I need this other file. That would be stupid, right? I mean, that would be the worst way to manage data, although, that said, I guess that's how they kind of had to use to do it. But now we've got file systems, and that's what their job is. so that if you want soccermedia.txt for whatever reason, whether you want to open it for reading it or you want to open it for editing or whatever, you don't have to say, okay, I know that that file exists from 0 to 484,600 bytes, and now I've just edited it and made it longer or shorter, so now I need to adjust all that. You know, you don't have to do that. That's what a file system is for. And that's really cool to understand, at least for this guy right here, because I didn't really understand that. I don't have the history with, old school computers or anything like that to really have ever known that. So that was one thing that I learned. That was fun. So if you didn't understand that, now you do, or to some degree at least. And I know a couple of people who don't. I mean, you say file system to them, and you can see that they know that a disk has to be in a certain format for their computer to accept it, but they don't understand what the heck it is going on, is what it's doing. And I'm not saying I understand what it's doing exactly, but I understand a little bit further now than I did before, which is nice. So another thing that I understand now is that you can actually detect what kind of file system something is by looking at the bytes, the actual bytes that start the file system itself. For instance, you'd need to be root to do this, or you could just do su-c, but if you do an dd infile if equals /dev/sdd1, for instance, so that'd be the first partition of sdd, space count equals 10, they say is all you'd probably need, space pipe, space file, space dash. That reads the first 10 bytes of that partition, sdd1, and pipes it into the file command. And so the file should identify for you what kind of partition that is, simply by, you know, because that's what file does. It's its job to identify files, the file types. And it really, really works. And it's really, really cool, because all you're doing is you're copying the raw bytes from the header of that partition, sending it into file, and you get back what kind of file system that is. So the next time you're trying to mount something and it says you must define the file type or the file system type first, try this nifty little trick, because it could do the trick for you. The shorter version of that, as it turns out, is file space dash s space /dev/sdd1. I like the dd one because it tells you what you're doing. You know, you're copying the bytes from the partition up to 10 bytes, and then you're sending that to file, and you're using the input of the pipe as the input of file, and you're reading it, and you're decoding it, and you're finding out what kind of file system it is. So that was kind of neat to try, and very demonstrative of what's really going on. But either way, it's a really cool trick if you need to know sort of almost the inverse of that and figure out what mount has automagically tried, because of course mount usually does try to mount the thing automatically without bothering to ask you for the file system type. If you want to know what it has tried, try mount-v space /dev/sdd1, or whatever you're trying to mount, and then slash, of course, the destination /mnt or /media/zip, whatever you use. So mount-v is a good trick to know as well. Strictly for work, I attended an AVID training session. AVID, if you don't know, it used to be the industry standard. Like, people who grew up, or I guess built their career cutting films, it was, and even TV, it was AVID. That was what you spoke of when you spoke of nonlinear editing. There really wasn't another solution. Now, that's not entirely true. Of course, there were other solutions. There were other products out there, but the name that you would first encounter and assume people were using was AVID. That changed when Final Cut Pro got released and kind of displaced the entire industry, really. It really made a huge splash, and now the industry is trying to figure out where to go. Now, from the moment Final Cut faltered, I was telling as many people as I could that now would be a great time for Caden Live to move in. But Caden Live obviously has a lot going against it, because it runs on a completely different operating system, and I think that's probably the only thing it has going against it right now, other than it's something different. But then again, a lot of things are different, so that, I think, more than anything, it's the operating system. And obviously Caden Live doesn't have exactly a multi-million dollar corporation pushing it forward into the minds of everyone, so that's a little bit of a disadvantage, but it doesn't really matter. It does matter. It matters a lot. It would be great if Caden Live could just swing in there and steal all that market, but I don't see that happening right now. And besides that, Avid's kind of an easy target because people who had gone one way can now kind of swing back the other way, and the prices have come down. You know, the playing field has been leveled by competition, which is, I guess, what's supposed to happen. And that's actually something I was thinking of. It got nothing to do with what I'm about to speak about. But if you think about competition in software these days, doesn't it feel like there's not that much? You know, I mean, if you think of, at least that I can think of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the big things that I can think of in the proprietary world, there's no competition. You know, it's sort of, here's this package for this function. And, I mean, yeah, there are alternatives for hobbyists and things like that, but you don't actually see that much diversity in the professional market, which is really weird. Happily, that's not the case in the video editing market. There are actually, I'd say, 2, 3, maybe even 4, if you kind of stretch it a little bit, viable alternatives. Again, all proprietary, if we're looking at that market. I mean, there'd be 5 or 6 viable alternatives if you're including free software, which would be nice, but it doesn't really happen that much right now. But you've got a lot of competition, and I think that's a good thing, you know, diversity and choice, things like that. And given the fact that there's not that much choice in the proprietary world, it kind of underscores the strength of that almost cliche phrase of, part of the greatest thing about free software is the choice that you have. I used to kind of dismiss that in, maybe it was like a weak excuse because, yeah, it's like this awkward kind of thing that we all know. We have 23 different text editors and lots of different music editors and lots of different office suites and all these other things. But honestly, like given the proprietary state of things in proprietary software, the choice is one of the huge things. And I know that it confuses people and it makes you dizzy if you think about it too much, but at least you've got the choice, really, seriously, not as an excuse. I'm saying really as you have the choice. And that's a huge, huge thing. And so for that reason, I don't think we should complain too much that we have choice, because that is not something that you see in the proprietary world, at least that I can think of. Not really. I mean, you do, but you don't, you know? So anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's a different topic, probably something that panelists could argue or something. But for what I'm saying here, I was at this training thing because I had to go for work because they want to scout out alternatives for what they've been using. And it was interesting to be in one of these training sessions in such a completely detached state of mind. I'm never going to use this software. I don't have to use it. I don't really have to deal with it. I'll have to support it a little bit, but not really. I mean, I'll just have to make sure it gets installed, basically. And that'll be more or less the extent of my involvement. So I came to this meeting very, very detached, and it was a very familiar sort of thing for me, because I used to, even before I got into free software, I used to eat up these kinds of things. You know, you offer me an hour of free training on any given software package, even if it's something that I don't use, I'm there. You give me free coffee while I'm there, I'm doubly there. I've kind of replaced that with technical conferences like Ohio Linux Fest, Southeast Linux Fest, B-Sides, different conferences that I get to go to. But I love that sort of thing. I really do. I like software. I like learning about software. It's just, you know, I don't know why. I just do. So I was here in this familiar setting, hearing a fairly familiar sales pitchy kind of, oh, I'm training you on this, but I'm really trying to sell you on it kind of thing. And it was very interesting because I didn't actually care and I didn't need to care. So I was sitting there listening to all of this stuff. And there are these features, you know, a lot of features that were really interesting to see, because I'd never looked at Avid myself. I'd never needed to, and by the time by the time the prices of Avid were far enough down that I might have been advantageous for me to look at it, I didn't need to, because I was using free software, so who cares? But I was seeing all these features, noticing internally how like Caden Live actually really can compete with Avid completely. I mean, there were some features, I guess, that weren't there on Caden Live that were there on Avid, and vice versa. So, I mean, really, it's a competitor. No kidding, it's a competitor. So if there was any doubt about that, let there not be doubt about that. That it's, if someone says, oh, I use Avid, I want to use something on free software, you can point them to Caden Live, full confidence. I mean, yes, they'll have little things that are different, and they'll complain, and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, you can stand firm and say, no, this is a direct competitor. End of story. So, that was interesting. Very nice to see. I really liked how technical this program was, as opposed to the sort of weird kind of non-tech talk you get at a lot of the other video editing demonstrations by other companies. So that was really interesting. They really knew their stuff, which was really interesting for me to hear. It seemed unique to me, which is saying something, because I was certified on Final Cut. I'd been through training, and the things that they talked about in those two different training sessions were noticeably different. So anyway, I'm sitting there, I'm looking at this stuff, interesting, don't care. And I'm listening to people asking questions, and, you know, it's this out-of-body sort of experience, because I'm just sitting there waiting, biding my time until they bring out the free pizza, and I'm hearing all this stuff, and it suddenly dawns on me that everyone in this room, practically, but maybe one or two people, are there shopping around for a Final Cut Pro alternative, first of all. And so now here I am in an environment, in a hostile environment, where the person trying to sell this product is up against a well-known and much beloved product, and he's trying to sell them on this alternative. Now, they've come to him because they feel abandoned by their former editor, but it is his burden of proof. And I thought, wow, how do you like how that feels, Mr. DigiDesign avid salesperson, to have to sell your product to people who, the minute you say, look how cool this is, they raise their hand and say, yeah, but it's the wrong color, or, oh, I don't like that button there, I want it a little bit to the left, or stupid stuff like that, you know, things where they're comparing it to exactly what they know, and they want it to be exactly like what they want to know. So I guess, in short, what I'm trying to say is that people look for replacements, not alternatives. That's an important distinction that I kind of invented. You know, you've got an alternative, meaning, well, I like Audacity for sound wave editing, but I'm starting to do a lot of multi-track editing in it, so I'd like to move up. That's not a replacement. That's an alternative. Could even argue that, I guess, that's like an upgrade or something, but that's an alternative, right? They want to kind of, they're happy with what they want, but they have a knowledge that they've outgrown it, and so they need something better, or they need something more. Maybe not even better, just more. Or perhaps, for instance, I like Ardour, but I've been using so much Qt software, or Qt software, that I want something a little bit more designed for the system that I'm already running, a little bit more integrated. The alternative would be Qtractor. So that's an alternative. But I think, and this is something that we in the GNU Linux community kind of suffer from, and I don't think we fully understand it, and that's why this was kind of such a revelation for me. When people look for replacements, that's not the same thing. It's not an alternative. They want what they had, and that somehow got taken away from them. And so they want the same thing. And I wonder if we've all been there. You know, because, I mean, admit it, when you first came to Linux, were you looking for an alternative, or were you looking for a replacement? I know I thought that I was looking for an alternative, but really I was looking for a replacement for the first 2-3 years of my GNU Linux usage. And you kind of settle into the idea that this is not a replacement. You know, you get used to it gradually. You're like, okay, I understand this isn't working exactly like my old operating system. And when you get to that realization, then you start to kind of accept the fact that you're not looking for a replacement, that you are looking for an alternative, and that you have to decide that things are going to be different and that you're going to be okay with that. I mean, I still, to some degree, moan about not having a global menu bar. I got so used to, I mean, that global menu bar is all I ever knew in my entire life. That was a computer to me. It had a global menu bar. I admit, at this point, and this is like very recent, like within the past maybe 2 or 3 months, I've started to realize that global menu bars might not be a necessary component on a computer. I'm not sold on that idea, but I'm willing to talk about it. I'm coming to the table to discuss that idea with some people. Not really, but if there were people to discuss that, I would be at their table. And it's really been only since KDE 4.8, I think, where they've got that little, I guess we could call it a Chromium style, just a little wrench icon up in the upper right-hand corner, you know, so you don't have a global menu bar. You just have like this little thing in the corner that you can click on, and you get all your menu options that you would normally have in the top of your window. I think that's a brilliant compromise. I don't get my global menu bar, but so far the implementations of a global menu bar I haven't really loved on Linux anyway. So there's that. I'm willing to compromise because I just don't feel like it's the same thing. Or maybe I'm just so used to it now that now I'm having a hard time accepting a global menu bar on Linux. But I still get, or rather, I have to have the menu bar in each of my windows, but I don't have to sacrifice the vertical space and have the persistent file, edit, view, options, settings, window, help thing, or about, whatever it is, at the top of every single window, which drives me nuts to see all that text just across every single window. Give me a little wrench icon or whatever it is, a gear icon, whatever you want. Let me click it, then let me see the menus for that window. That's a really good compromise. Sorry, that was a total digression. The point being that people aren't looking for alternatives, unless they are. Unless there's probably a rare person who says, I really can't stand the way this thing works. I want to try something with a completely different style of working. I want to go down a completely new path, learn a whole new paradigm. I just want it to be completely different. There are probably people like that. And I think that, honestly, when I went to GNU Linux, I did want that. That was one of the motivating factors. You know, I wanted a new desktop. I wanted something that looked different, that felt different. But I wasn't prepared for just how different it was all going to be. So I was deep down looking for a replacement. And I think a lot of people are. And I think that's a problem. Because when people come into a Linux technical convention or something, and they're sitting down, and they're like, all right, show me video editing on Linux. And you're like, okay, this is really cool. Here's Kdenlive Live. Look at this color corrector. It's so incredible. And they're like, yeah, but it's not round. Yeah, but it's a curve, and you can adjust the color balance within the mids without changing, you know, without adding a whole new filter and stuff. You can be so precise, and they're just like, yeah, but it's not a circle. And it's so irritating. Why can you not understand how this is so much better? And it's because they're looking for the exact same thing. They want what they had before. They just don't want to pay for it, or they just don't want it to ever change, or whatever. So it's an important distinction, and it's something that I really, really got in this training session, of all things, for proprietary software that I'm never going to use. But everyone in that room was they were just, you could hear them silently begging that this software would be exactly like they were what they were used to. And I mean it's great to know that that's not a free software problem. It's not only our problem. It is a problem of those few proprietary software applications that exist that are an alternative to other proprietary software. You know, they have that problem as well. And so free software, we do suffer from that probably profoundly. Because you not only need people to come to you at the point that they're fed up with what they had, but then you also have to get over that resistance of, you know, they see the alternative and they're like, well, is the ratio correct? Am I so fed up with what I have right now that I can do this learning curve? Or does this learning curve look steep enough so that I'm okay with what I hate? That's a really tricky thing, and I honestly don't know. I don't want to give us like a cop-out, like a free ride or anything, and say, oh, well, we don't have to worry about it, it's not our fault. But at the same time, I don't know what we can do about that. I really don't. Windows Vista came out, and people are still using Windows. I mean, explain that if you can. So, be aware of that. It's just an interesting thing that I noticed from an unlikely source. It was eye-opening for me. So hopefully that kind of puts some things into perspective for you as well. Fedora 17, the beefy miracle is what they're calling it, and it's out, it's released, it's live, and finished, complete. So I decided, just because I've got lots of computers now, I decided to go ahead and update to Fedora 17 on the box that runs Fedora, and I learned something. And I was talking to someone about upgrading, you know, the concept of upgrading. And this is an always hot topic, you know, it's always easy to talk about the pitfalls and the triumphs of upgrading. It's something that I guess will just always be something that people are talking about around computers for a long time. It doesn't matter your operating system. It's something that you have to consider and kind of think about, and it's something that you can benchmark and take samples of when you're evaluating your operating system. Upgrades for me have always been uneventful in the best of ways, but I was taught from the very beginning that before you upgrade, you back everything up. You favor complete, full upgrades, things like that, rather than than just updates. You know, a reinstall, I guess, is what I'm saying. And so, I don't know. They've always been pretty uneventful. And I never really understood, to be honest, the appeal of an upgrade as opposed to a full reinstall. I thought full reinstalls kind of sounded pretty good. And they still do. I mean, I think part of me still prefers a full install. But in practice, I tend to kind of go back and forth depending on what's going on in my life around the time that I want to install. Now, I've never rushed to upgrade or reinstall, for that matter. That's not really ever been something that, again, that I've been trained to do. Ignore the hype and just kind of upgrade when you are ready, when there's a need to upgrade. And I think that's the deciding factor of whether you do an upgrade, like a system update, essentially, to the next release, or you do a full reinstall. Because if you are in the middle of a project and you are finding that that project just can't be finished without a full upgrade for some reason, you know, big system upgrade, then you have to do the upgrade for whatever reason it is. Maybe you just need better performance and you know that the upgrade will give it to you, or you need the proverbial new driver. Whatever you're looking for, there might be a reason that you have to upgrade. But if you are in the middle of the project, obviously a full reinstall would slow you down and even to some degree risk the health of your data. You know, I mean, if you've got a complex sound project going on, or a, probably even like a programming project where there's a lot of underlying interconnectedness involved that you really want to maintain and protect, a full reinstall would be the best way to blow all of that away. So that's not necessarily something that you want to do. Or maybe you're just pressed for time and you want or need to upgrade, but you know that you can't afford to spend a day rebuilding the software and the different plugins and little support libraries that you decide you need on your system and recompiling things just the way that you want it. I mean, we're all Linux users here. Most of us have little tweaks that we like to make. That's part of why we use Linux. So a reinstall is not usually a super trivial thing. Even on my old OS, it was not really ever trivial because there were still lots of applications that you would install. In my case, most applications I would install on top of the base OS. I can't ever remember a time. I mean, if I try really hard, I can sort of remember. I mean, before I even understood what software was, that would be the time. But in my conscious computer usage time, I can't remember when I ever used just the stuff that they gave me on the operating system disk. You know, it's just always been, okay, the OS is installed, now go out to the internet and download all the software that I need. It was just a given. So whether you're doing a full reinstall or an upgrade depends on lots of different things. For this Fedora box, because it's not a critical box, it's just my spare computer in my spare workroom. I use it honestly mostly for Emacs, although I'll watch some videos and things like that on it. But mostly it's a writing computer and kind of a sandbox for any new networking thing that I'm thinking about implementing and I want to test it out first. So I figured, why not? I'll do a live update. You know, I'll do an upgrade of the whole system via Yum, because that's how I'd done it in the past. And don't do this right now, but, you know, essentially you go to run level 3, init 3, and then you do the Yum update of Yum so that your updater itself is up to date. You do the Yum clean all to get rid of all the cache that Yum would have lying around now, and then you get the release version that you want and the GPG key, and you update your entire base system from Fedora 16 to Fedora 17. I learned when I went to look up the exact steps of this that this is not actually the supported method of updating a system, which was literally news to me. This might be common knowledge, but somehow that had escaped me, that the upgrading via Yum was not the preferred method of upgrading a Fedora box. This was news to me. I'd never heard this before. So it was really interesting to read. And, of course, in Fedora 17, this is an underscored, not supported method, because in Fedora 17, there are new symlinks from bin to user bin, sbin to user sbin, lib to user lib, lib64 to user lib64. So those are no longer really directories. Those are not actually there anymore. Everything's just being put into /user/whatever. So really, really tricky on Fedora 17 to do anything via Yum, because it's just the whole system, the root level of your system is actually changing. So it might have been easier to do this from like 15 to 16. It still wasn't supported, I guess, but it's especially difficult and I guess a little bit dangerous to do this from 16 to 17 or 15 to 17, whatever. Turns out that the supported method is to go grab the ISO, which I did via BitTorrent. It came down really, really fast. This wasn't on release day. This was like the day after or maybe 2 days after. Grabbed the DVD installer, booted off of the DVD on this computer, and simply walked through the steps. I mean, it was just a point-and-click kind of install thing, and it detected that there was already a Fedora Linux system on the computer, so it offered to do an upgrade for me. I accepted that offer, told it which partition to upgrade, which was the only partition, and just kind of kept clicking, you know, okay, next, okay, next, okay, next. It ran a special script, I noticed, for the linking, the symlinking of the slash bin and the slash sbin and stuff like that to the slash usr slash bin slash usr slash sbin and so on. So that was, I don't know, something that I just couldn't help but notice. I mean, it pops up a little notice that it's doing that, and so that's interesting and kind of indicative of what kind of upgrade this really is. It is a major upgrade. And then it ran for a little while and just copied all the important stuff from the DVD to the hard drive. Now, because this is my backup, just a spare computer, and really doesn't have any important data on it at all, I'm talking zero important data, I didn't even bother backing up because there was really nothing to back up. So this was an interesting experience too, because I kind of had a morbid curiosity. Believe me, if this had had any important data on it, I would not have done that. But I did have a morbid curiosity as to how this would work out. You know, I thought this will be really interesting to see if all this sort of temporary data that I have on this computer that exists either on other drives or other servers or just doesn't really matter to me at all, it'll be interesting to see what happens when I reboot. You know, will this stuff still be there? Well, turns out the update went really, really well. It was almost a no-brainer. There were a couple of questions during the upgrade that you had to kind of think about. You know, it was like, well, do I want to reinstall the grub configuration file, or do I want to keep the configuration file that I have? And why would I want to keep the one if it's installing new stuff? So, okay, I want to do the new one. So there were a couple of things that you had to stop and kind of think about logically, just because it was giving you two choices. But in terms of upgrades, I mean, it was pretty simple. It was pretty basic. And it was fairly quick. I don't know, I walked away from the computer and kind of lost, you know, I came back to it later. So I don't know how quick it was. It wasn't like I was sitting there tapping my fingers. But it seemed fairly quick. It was certainly the point of getting to the OK Computer takeover and upgrade yourself. That was easy and simple and quick enough. I walked away, came back later, it was done. I rebooted. There was nary a hiccup. It was just, you know, it came back. It rebooted and the splash screen or the GDM, whatever, came back. And now I had fireworks instead of Jules Verne submarine. And I logged in and my old wallpaper was there. All my data was there. The whole, everything was still configured. It was great. I ran a quick Yum update just to make sure that I got all the recent stuff, and all the software that I'd installed, whether it was from RPM Fusion or from Fedora repositories, it was all up to date. It had been updated. It was just really, really cool. It was a pleasure, in fact. Because show me a system that can do an upgrade like that, with that kind of completion, and you're probably showing me a Linux distribution. And that's just a fact. And the beauty there is that the software, both the official and the extras, are being managed by a packaging system. And I kind of touched on this last episode, and I don't want to become like a packaging system fanboy, because my primary operating system is Slackware, which does not have really a package manager to speak of. So I don't want to keep reiterating how great Yum and Aptitude are, but it's kind of something to take note of, largely because you see other operating systems trying to get in on that action, which is such a unique position for Linux users to be in, I think. I really don't think that we've often been in that position where people are really quite blatantly, and as usual, they're not advertising it. They're not saying, new Linux-like package management. You know, they're not saying that. They're saying, new revolutionary method of package, of application installation. And they're spinning it for themselves as usual. It's only to be expected. There are companies with marketing teams. That's what they specialize in. But the fact is, if you use Linux, then you know that, well, first of all, you know that they're copying Linux. And second of all, you know how it's supposed to work. And if you look at other systems, they're nowhere near that yet. And that's really cool. That's something to be proud of. And it's even more than that, just something to kind of relax into. And if you're careful and if you manage your system rationally and you don't go out to every possible RPM site and just install whatever the heck you want because you need it right now and you can't be bothered to wait until someone packages it properly or whatever the case may be. If you're careful and you kind of play by a certain set of rules, then when you do an upgrade, everything upgrades and everything is just perfect and clean and in sync, and it's really, really impressive. Now balance that out with the freedom to not do that and the freedom to say to yourself, I'm not going to play by their rules. I'm going to grab RPMs from whatever site I so please. I'm going to build my own. I'm going to make my own repository, whatever. And you can do that, and that's fine. And the upgrade will still work. You'll just have to manually upgrade certain packages. I don't see that that's a problem. It's something to be aware of. The point being that you've got a lot of flexibility with Linux, which we've known for a long time. Either way, it can work really, it tends to work really, really well, as long as you know what you're doing. I mean, it's going to break if you have no clue what you're doing, or if you're just not really keeping track of what you're doing. But the same can be said of any system. I mean, if you're just installing random stuff without any real awareness of what you're doing, yeah, things are going to eventually break. And I've seen that on other operating systems, or rather the inverse of that on other operating systems. Gort being a primary example, he keeps all the installers of every application that he installs. You know, he keeps them in dedicated folders. I mean, he basically recreates his own ports tree in a way. I mean, except that there's no code there. But, you know, it's a complete directory of all the stuff that he has downloaded and installed. So he's got a history of everything that he's done on that computer in terms of what has been installed, what could possibly be failing. You know, he's always got that sort of history of stuff that he can go back to. And he's got all that stuff backed up on top of that. So very meticulous computer manager, and that's cool. And because of that reason, he doesn't have, I mean, also because he knows what he's doing in general, but he doesn't have like weird computer failures that no one can explain. And of course, you've seen people on any operating system, whether it's proprietary or not, where they just have no idea what they're doing, they're not managing things very well, and sure enough, things break. But anyway, the bottom line is that the Fedora 17 upgrade went really, really well. It's great. I mean, it's super slick. It's really nice. I don't know what to say about it. All I can say is that it upgraded really well. Everything was in sync. Everything was up to date. Everything still works. I got no complaints. That's really all you want, right? Last but not least, GIMP 2.8. Okay, I admit it, GIMP 2.8 is the reason I was really, really compelled to upgrade to Fedora 17. I wanted to try GIMP 2.8. And I have to say that I'm not at all disappointed. This was a long time coming, as you know. We've been on 2.6 nearly as long as I've been on Linux. I kid you not. I did come in at 2.4. I remember that. But 2.6 is basically what I remember. You know, GIMP is 2.6. Well, that changes today. Or a couple of days ago. A couple of weeks ago. So yeah, 2.8 is out for real. It's a release. It's an honest release. They've declared it a new stable version. And it's a big deal. And the biggest deal about it, the big selling point, the big thing that people are talking about and should be talking about, is the single window mode. Understand, this makes no sense, okay? There aren't image editors out there, of the two that I know of, that are single window. That's not entirely true, actually. Krita was single window for quite some time, but that's not really an image editor, not the way that GIMP and its proprietary competitor are image editors. So really, you know, the big one that everyone's comparing GIMP to, and they always compare to that, is not single window. It's multi-window. I don't even think that there's a single window mode available in that application that everyone compares GIMP to. However, there's an important difference with how the windows act. And with GIMP, all three windows, or two if you managed it like I did before I got the single window mode, but your palette window and your canvas window, the operating system, the GTK, whatever, sees them as two separate instances. They don't ever do the same thing together. And that will drive you patently insane. I mean, it was enough to make me want to throw the computer out the window at certain times. It was just that bad. Not when you're just sitting around using it because you feel like doing some GIMP work. That's not when it makes you angry. It's when you have five different applications open already. You're up against a deadline. You're trying to get this thing done. You swing back to another desktop to go back into GIMP. You're looking for your palette window and you cannot find it. So you alt tab. Still can't find it. The thing's lost. It just got lost in the shuffle. So you save your work, you quit GIMP, you relaunch GIMP, and then you're back. Understand that's not an everyday thing, but when it happens, it aggravates you to no end. It's like, it's so frustrating. So what I used to do to fight against that was I would pin the palette window to all desktops, so it would always be in the background somewhere, and then I would flip back to GIMP and there it would still be because it's on all desktops. Or I would say it was always on top on that particular desktop. I would do something to specify that it was a special window, and that worked. That was a good workaround, and it's something that I did when I was in the frenzy GIMP mode, as opposed to just kind of everyday GIMP usage, where it wasn't really that big of a deal. The subtle thing that was a bigger deal, again, not a deal breaker, obviously, but it was something to think about during normal GIMP usage, was just those occasions that you would, you know, the focus following the mouse worked, but it wasn't the same, you know, so you'd be over one window, and you'd press a keyboard shortcut that you would expect to do one thing, and it wouldn't do that thing because you were on the wrong window, or you'd go over to your palette and click to select some tool that you don't know the keyboard shortcut for, and you'd realize the first click didn't do it, so you'd have to click again because the first click just raised that window to focus, and then you have to click again to actually get the tool that you wanted. Little things like that would just kind of drive you, maybe not insane, but nuts, a little bit nuts. So that got on my nerves. The positive side of that, I guess, if there's a positive side, is that you end up using keyboard shortcuts anyway, so you don't really have to worry about the palette usually. But then the other side of annoyance there is that you could never get rid of your tool palette. If I could have gotten rid of the tool palette entirely and just had my layers and my brush and my font palette, then I think I'd be less annoyed that the tool palette wasn't acting the way it was supposed to act. But the fact that I couldn't ditch it at all kind of annoyed me. So lots of weird annoyances in the multi-window setup that, granted, in concept, it doesn't seem like that should have been a bad idea. It seemed like the multi-window thing was a logical idea. It seemed normal. It seemed like what everyone else was doing. Other applications that involve palettes and a canvas and multi-windows, they go to multi-window configuration. But the absence of a proper floating window type in GTK, I guess, did really get weird. That's no longer a problem. It kind of freaked me out. I started GIMP 2.8, and it was still multi-window, but just go to the window menu setting and tell it to go to single window, and then it stays in single window. So that's how you get that. It's great. It's well worth it. It's just fantastic. They've got other little tweaks. I mean, they've done something that makes me very happy. They've given more screen real estate for the dockable dialog boxes, palettes, I guess. That was much appreciated. Something just a little touch that you just really, really nice. And then there's the ever-essential layer grouping. This was so important, really, honestly. No kidding. This is like one of those, this was almost a deal-breaker multiple times. Again, it's not every day when you're just taking a photograph in to do some color correction, do some contrast correction or manipulation. Not that big of a deal. When you're doing a serious layout, or not layout, you shouldn't be doing layout in GIMP, but you know, you're doing a serious, like, composited image where you've got all these different elements and you've got little tiny tweaks, you know, sometimes you'll have like a layer and all it is one little black dot for Tux's right eye because the illustrator sent you something and the circle wasn't quite right. So all you had to do was fix that one little thing, and you don't want to, there's no reason to compress your layers at this point. You know, you want the flexibility to have all these different layers, or maybe it's not his eye, maybe it's a reflection on his eye, and you don't want to compress that yet because you're not sure that you want it there, or you're not sure at what blur level you want it, whatever. Point is, you've got layers upon layers upon layers, and if there's no way to group them and say, okay, all of these layers, all these five layers, are all Tux's right eye, One is his pupil, one is the reflection off of his pupil, this one's the white background for it, this one's his eyelid, and these are his eyelashes. All five layers. His eyeball. The worst thing in the world. You know, you want to move Tux, and suddenly you realize, oh, I've got to get all these other ones that compose his eye, and then you need to link them all together with that little chain, and then you go through and you unlink them when you're finished moving them. It was terrible. So that exists. Layer groups exists, and that's really, really cool. There's a whole different system now. It's I guess, Cairo for the rendering of the graphics. It looks slicker to me, and a lot of the movement seems to be a lot better, but to be fair, I have not yet used a graphic that is really, really big to where I feel like I can go crazy and really get a feel for, oh, this is so much better versus this is interestingly better. So no firm review of that yet, I guess, in terms of Cairo performance versus whatever else. But it does look nice, and it feels better so far. And of course, the really, 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 really big deal, I think, is the text tool has been fixed in a huge way. I mean, this was another thing that, for me, to be honest, it wasn't really that big of a deal. I got around this really easily. I never really minded it, but it's just, it was a real eyesore when showing GIMP to other people, because the text editing, where you have this other little window that pops up, and you can't even do word-specific changes. You would have to, if you wanted a word, you wanted to say, Red Hat 6.0, let's say, or Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6.0, let's say, and you wanted the red to be colored red, and then Hat Enterprise Linux 6.0 to be white, let's say. So you're doing a stylish thing. Well, in your text, you couldn't do that. You couldn't just select the word red and say, red and say, okay, I want that to be red and the rest to be white. You'd have to duplicate your text layer, delete everything but red, and then on the other copy, remove red and not everything else. So you'd have two text layers, and then you could make the red word red and everything else would be white, but they'd be on two separate layers. Now, then you could compress them later, but what if you didn't want to do that? What if you wanted to change the font or the kerning or something? You want to change some aspect of it, and now you have to do that same action on two different layers. And that's just an example. There are lots of other examples. Maybe you want a stylistic thing where you've got two different fonts. You know, you've got the catchy little catchphrase and then the brand name in cursive or something, but you want it all on the same layer, whatever. Point being, you couldn't do it before. You could do it in Inkscape, you know, I mean, it existed, that the technology to do that was ready for Linux, you know, it was there, but it wasn't in GIMP. So that was a real problem, because of everything on GIMP, that was the one feature I think that a lot of people, not myself, but other users, people coming to Linux or looking at Linux from other platforms, that is what they would be using that frequently, and they would look at it and they would just be like, wow, Photoshop version 5 all over again. And they were right. That was a very outdated way of doing text. So really an eyesore, really a pain in the neck for a lot of people. I'm really, really happy that it's better now. The weird thing for me, I mean, there are a lot of little things. If you go to gimp.org/release-notes/gimp-2.8.html, you can see all the release notes. These are just the ones that I've kind of been keeping an eye on and am really happy to have seen fixed. But the other weird thing that they did that I have no clue why they did this was they no longer do the whole save. You know, you can just save something as any format. You have to go to export now. And that really upsets me, because that was like one of my selling features of GIMP. That was when I showed people GIMP, I'd just be like, oh, look, you can just save it as, change the file extension to .png, and it just converts it for you. People were like, wow, that's really nice. And now that's not there anymore. You have to go to export. I really have no clue why they did that. Why couldn't you just save copy as or something like that? I don't know. It's got something, I feel like it must have something to do with, okay, I've got this image, and right now it's a multi-layer XCF format file, the GIMP native format, and I want it to be a PNG, but I don't want to leave XCF. I don't want to change what's in my canvas. I simply want to save it out as a PNG. And I'm feeling like on the old GIMP, and I'd have to do this to see, I'm feeling like on the old GIMP, if you did that, your canvas would then become the compressed PNG. I don't think that's right. I'm trying to understand why they would take that great feature away. And I've seen on some forums that it's possibly just so that they look more professional because other programs have an export function. Personally, I hate it. I think it's stupid. I think it's It's a great way of taking a really great feature that sped things up and simplified things and slow it down and obfuscate it. So, too bad for them, but given all the other improvements, I really don't feel the need to complain too much about that. All in all, GIMP 2.8 is an incredible improvement. It's just so exciting. Check it out if you use GIMP at all. You will love it. One last thing before we go. There is a new Fat Chance Lester album that has been released, and feel free to go listen to that, download it for free, use it in whatever you want to use it in. It is called Ghost of a Chance, and it's got 4 tracks on it. Some of them are quite long, and it's a good album. I enjoyed editing it. I had a lot of fun, and I enjoy listening to it now, so feel free to listen to it yourself. I've been getting some questions about it lately. People have asked if it was all on Linux, if I do Fat Chance Lester alone, all this other stuff. No, I don't do it alone. The band that played Fat Chance Lester was called Fat Chance Lester, and as we all know, they were lost in a what we presume to be a time vortex during a tragic freak earthquake when they were playing a gig in Atlantic City. So these tapes are all that remain of them, of course, and I'm simply editing them and kind of mashing them up and doing all kinds of things, because I don't actually have all the tracks in many cases. I just have the performance itself or the recording itself. So a lot of editing that I do is either layering different components on top of each other that they didn't mean to go together, or combining stuff that didn't have drums with drums, or, you know, just kind of, it really is more of a mashup, I would say, than anything, or just kind of cleaning up sound, doing optimization, and sometimes looping things and just kind of messing around with it. So it's a postmodern rock thing that sounds like progressive rock a lot of times from an earlier era. So that's the story behind that. All of my editing is done on Linux. The sound itself was not recorded to a computer at all. If I recall correctly, it was recorded to a Fostex hard drive recorder and mixer by the engineer, George. So it wasn't. It's not recorded onto my computer with a live band. It's something that was recorded to a hard drive directly, and I've got the digital files that I manipulate now. So there you go, that's the story. This album, Ghost of a Chance, is from the same, largely from the same sessions that Android and The Ruins of Earth, I think, came from. So I'd say the past 3 albums, Ghost of a Chance included, have a kind of similar tone and feel to them. The material that I'm starting to get into now is noticeably different. So there'll be a change of sound for them to some degree. I mean, it's still weird space stuff, but the new material is a little bit different. I'm thinking there must be a different lineup, which I'm going to have to kind of reverse engineer for myself, try to listen to who the players are and figure out what who was in the studio at that time. But yeah, there's a lot of recordings out there, so I'm going to be continuing with that just whenever I have a chance. So feel free to enjoy it. The link is being donated, the web space is donated by Skirlet, my friend Skirlet. So her website is Astiopod, A-E-S, like the encryption, A-E-S-D-I-O, like God, D-O, and pod, like, I guess, iPod. So astiopod.com/Lester. And you should be dropped off, when you go there, you should just be dropped off to the main little listing of all their albums, and the bottom most listing will be Ghost of a Chance. And of course, as always, you can get that in Ogg Vorbis or in AAC for iPods and other devices that don't play Ogg, but that do play AAC. If you want the FLAC copy, let me know. I have FLAC tarred up and ready to go, but I'm finding that not that many people are downloading the full FLAC versions of this stuff. I think rightfully so. They're really quite large, so I'm not going to post them. It'll be more of on a request-only kind of thing. So that's about it. Astiopod.com/Lester for the latest, greatest, weird space music for your ears. Enjoy. That's the end of the show. So thanks for listening. My name is Clat2. You can find me in IRC, usually on irc.freenode.net, almost always in Ogcast Planet, the channel Ogcast Planet, sometimes in Slackware, sometimes in Open Source Musicians, other channels like that. You can find me on IM, on Jabber, not Clat2, at jabber.org. You can email me at clat2@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
Practiced three times a week and played a rival group on Friday afternoon.